What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
What's stopping you?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN Radio. This is the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, we are here for you. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Now, if you're listening to us outside of North America, please dial the U.S. country code and then 205-271-2985. You can also shoot us an email if you prefer that, the address ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. We're going to get to a couple of emails here in just a moment or two. Rich Jesse is our producer today. Matt Kabinski is our phone screener. I believe Ace McKay is handling social media for us. So if you want to ask us a question via YouTube or Facebook, we're streaming there right now. Just put your question in the comments box. Ace will see it. He'll shoot it to us here in the studio, and we'll hopefully get it on today's program. Wide open phone lines to begin with, though, at 833-288-EWTN. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
Very well. How are you, my friend?
Oh, I'm doing decent. Thank you.
Don't think we've had a lunch update in about a week or so.
Well, you know, this weekend I did what I often do, which is just make a big pot of lentils.
Oh.
And then it's very easy. Then I just make some rice at night,
yeah.
You know, throw the rice and lentils in a pot, I mean, in a Tupperware, throw in a peach, and off to work I go.
It's fantastic.
Very, very low prep time, you know, day to day.
That sounds great. Adrienne is now working on a Mediterranean diet for she and I. I'll let you know how that works
All
out.
All right. Yeah, that's
very
good stuff.
We're going to lead off here with an anonymous email. Dr. Anders, I have a question about politics. I am a Catholic and am pro-life, of course, but I don't like politics. My non-Catholic friends sometimes challenge me and ask me my stance on abortion laws. Sometimes they cite examples that I just don't know much about, like high-risk pregnancies. So my question is, am I obligated to have an opinion on every aspect of this issue? Is it enough that I think abortion is wrong, even if I don't know what the political solution to the problem is? Thank you, Anonymous.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the question. I appreciate the question more than you know, right? I really do. We don't live in a direct democracy, and you are not tasked with legislating or adjudicating or administering the government.
It's a democratic republic, right?
Now, if we lived in ancient Greece, ancient Athens, where they actually did have a direct democracy, the male citizens of the polis actually did make the decisions about legislation and judgment and so forth. That's not your role in our civilization, right? You the care of the body politic has not been given to you, right? And so you are not obligated. It's not your responsibility to have a policy position on every issue that could pertain to government. As a Catholic, you're bound by certain moral imperatives.
Yeah.
But it's not obvious. It's not at all obvious. And if someone tells you it's completely obvious, and I think they're naive, or maybe they're selling you something, or they have an ideology, it's not at all obvious the way the moral imperatives of Catholicism translate into public policy in a pluralistic secular democracy.
Okay.
And Pope Benedict, when he was speaking to the Bundestag, the German parliament, made the point explicitly that unlike other world religions, Christianity and Catholicism in particular have never sought to impose a particular juridical order on society. That is not the job of the church, right? But rather to speak in broad terms about those moral imperatives and then encourage those who do have the care of the community, those whose responsibility it is to come up with and enforce policy, to implement policies that at least approximate that moral vision, right? But that's not your job. And I think that, in fact, your apathy, if you will, about the political sphere can be quite virtuous. There is a tendency in our culture to act like policy is the whole thing. And I have known Catholics, non-Catholics, and others that almost equate their religious identity with holding a set of policy positions. And to me, that doesn't scan at all with the example of Christ. I mean, you know, Christ didn't go around politicking about the latest imperial edict. He was almost entirely uninterested in such things. He was mm-hmm. interested in getting into men's hearts and changing the way they evaluated their neighbors. Not particularly interested in policy. Now, you know, there are those, say, Catholics in office that have to think about that kind of
stuff.
Sure. But you don't have to.
Got to be a relief for an awful lot of people.
Sure.
I would think so. Thanks so much for your email. Here's one now from Joe in Pennsylvania. The church teaches that the sins of all will be laid bare for all to see at the general judgment at the end of time. Does this include even confessed sins of the righteous? Thanks, Joe.
No, it does not. And thank you very much for the question. When your sins are forgiven, they're done, they're poof, they're gone, they're out of there. So the judgment of the righteous on the last day will be the judgment, well done, good and faithful servant.
And that's got to be a relief.
Yeah.
Wow. Super. All right, very good. And thank you so much for your email there, Joe in Pennsylvania. Here's a quick one now from Francine. Are Catholics worshiping idols? What's with all those statues?
I appreciate the question. Catholics are not worshiping idols. And the religious artwork, whether it's statues or paintings or icons, are there to direct the mind to the contemplation of divine things. And, you know, we think in images, in sentences, in words, in pictures, in sounds, sensorial representations. And we can't not think that way.
Yeah.
And it can be helpful to have things that draw your mind to the consideration of divine things. You know, the other day I was in Mass, and I had read about this guy who won a $1.3 billion lottery.
Yes.
And I was, believe it or not, I was sitting there, and in my mind's eye, I had sort of fantasizing, what would I do with $1.3 billion? Not a very useful thing to think about. And about that time, we read the gospel, and it was all about the dangers of wealth and, like, you know, renouncing possessions. And the priest says, you know, don't be thinking about what you can do with vast sums of money. And I went, oh, that's me he's talking about, you know.
Apparently
but I
so.
Could, but, you know, maybe I could have seen an image of St. Francis embracing Lady Poverty, for example.
Sure.
And it could have had the same effect.
Very good. Thanks so much for your question, Francine. In a moment, we'll get to the phones here and talk with Linda in Iowa, also Stephanie in Somerville, Ohio. And there's a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. It's Call to Communion for you here on this Wednesday afternoon here on EWTN. Our phone number 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. By golly, we have one line open right now, so you can grab it and give us your question for Dr. David Anders. I want to tell you about a wonderful thing now being offered by EWTN's religious catalog. It is the American-Born Heroes of the Church Rosary, designed in conjunction with premier Italian rosary maker Gorelli, exclusively for EWTN. This beautiful tribute to the American-born heroes of the church is made with smooth, round, red, white, and blue glass beads from the Czech Republic. The crucifix features God the Father with Jesus on the cross and the Holy Spirit in the form of a dove above Jesus' head. On the reverse of the crucifix is an eagle in flight below three stars as a reflection of the Trinity and a quote from the scriptures that read, "He will raise you up on eagle's wings." That, of course, from Psalm 91. Now, the centerpiece is a figure of our Blessed Mother, inspired by the beautiful painting of the Immaculate Conception, and each of the Our Father medals features a saintly American-born hero of the Catholic Church, people like St. Catherine Drexel, Blessed Solanus Casey, St. Kateri Tekakwitha, St. Elizabeth Ann Seton, and Blessed Michael J. McGivney of the Knights of Columbus. Hey, it's available right now at EWTNRC.com. Looking at a picture of it, it is just beautiful. EWTNRC.com. Do check that out. If you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. We begin with Linda in Iowa. And Linda, what's on your mind today?
Hi, I want to thank you both for your show. I My question arises from a conversation I had with my daughter recently, who's in her mid-20s and was facing a big decision that she had to make in her career. And so she came to me for advice, and we were talking about, you know, how to make a good decision objectively and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things she asked me about was how to pray, you know, seeking God's help when you're making a decision. And the one thing she said that I really didn't know how to respond was when you hear people say things like, well, I had this decision, and so I took it to God, and, you know, I asked him to give me a sign, and he did, and, you know, then everything was, of course, you know, wonderful because I did what, you know, God had told me to do. And, you know, she said, when I try that, it doesn't work. And then, you know, I think sometimes it can make people even lose their faith or falter because they think, okay, well, these people are getting their prayers answered, and, you know, how come, you know, God isn't talking to me on a megaphone or something like he seems to be with these other people? And then kind of dovetailing off of that is I've really been thinking a lot about how you have spoken lately about meditating on the words of Christ and the Our Father, and really, you know, that shows us all the ways to pray. However, you know, then there are times that I do think, you know, like St. Paul says, pray without ceasing, and there are, you know, very small things that I find myself praying to, you know, God, help me find this lost item, or, I, you know, things that obviously aren't in the Lord's Prayer. So could you just speak about that? I don't want to pray in a frivolous nature, and I certainly don't want to, you know, lead my children into that type of thing either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If all that makes sense.
Yeah, these are great questions. They're fabulous questions. They really go to the heart of Christian spirituality, so I deeply appreciate them. There was a major shift in the cultural milieu of Western Christianity that took place, say, you know, probably in the last 30 years. And this was the shift. The shift was towards a type of spirituality where people had an expectation that God would, as a matter of course, give them some kind of private revelation for the determination of day-to-day decisions, right? And some of them might conceptualize that as hearing a voice in their head, or maybe a strong impression or a feeling, or they mm-hmm. would be looking for signs that they would discern in their experience. But however they worked it out, the expectation was that, you know, if I need to know, you know, what flavor mustard to buy at the grocery store, I can send up a query, and I'll get back a reliable answer. And so there are any number of books and seminars that are available in the wider sort of Christian orbit, and I'm not limiting this to Catholicism by any stretch of the imagination, that purport to tell people how to read the tea leaves, so to speak, to discern reliably the voice of God. Now, I am, as you've probably discerned, unbelievably skeptical of that enterprise. I'm unbelievably skeptical of it. I think what often tends to happen is that one of two things. One is that when people operate that way, they merely stipulate, okay, when I get this feeling, that means that God is talking to me.
Okay.
Right? And so then once you've persuaded yourself in advance that there's some sort of infallible set of criterion that whenever you experience them, that just means God's talking to you, well, then you're always going to hear God talking to you, but it's only by this form of stipulation, right?
Sure.
And it's a bit like playing make-believe when a child says, okay, let's let this chair stand for a lion. So, you know, if you step on that chair, you get eaten. And as long as you operate within the terms of the game, you can reliably discern the presence of the lion, so to speak, right? But it all depends on the stipulation and then the willing suspension of disbelief. Like, I'm going to ignore the fact that it doesn't look anything like a lion.
Right.
That's how this functions. Now, the games of make-believe are harmless. The problem with this when applied to the life of prayer is that you make a pact with yourself, and all this takes place unconsciously, right? You make a pact with yourself to turn off the critical faculty. the child has an ability to step out of the game of make-believe when it's dinner time and actually sit in the chair and have dinner without being consumed by the lion, right? But the superstitious Christian has made a pact with himself not to turn off that critical faculty. And so they commit themselves in advance to pursuing a course of action that is basically grounded in something akin to, you know, to reading tea leaves or casting cracked bones or something. And then when circumstances don't work out as they had anticipated, then they double down on their interpretation, lest their religious identity be threatened. And it can it's prey to all kinds of confirmation bias and other forms of delusion. And I speak about this passionately because I have fallen prey to this in my own prayer life. And there have been episodes in my life when I was running in these circles and I felt like, you know, I have to have these tangible evidences of God's direction in my life, you know, down to very specific instances. Mm. And so I'll stipulate these conditions. If this happens, that means God's talking to me or God's leading me. And the downstream consequences of that are very bad. And when people rely on these kind of techniques to make very large life decisions, like who should I marry? Mm. Should I take this job? How many children should I have? Then it can be, you know, rather than being guided by reason, which Thomas Aquinas tells us is the rule for human action, right? Not weird, spooky intuitions, but reason, right? And reason is responsive prudently to things like counsel, right, and experience. Instead of that, then I'm relying on these really irrational things, and I can do all kinds of harm to myself. The other thing that people will do, I think, sometimes in prayer is, and this is particularly when they're trying to discern the will of God from a set of circumstances. Circumstances are always inherently ambiguous, and they're nearly infinite in variety. I mean, in any given moment in my life, there's so many things that could occupy my sphere of awareness that I have to be very selective in what I pay attention to. And so we typically get drawn to what's flashy or what's familiar, and we ignore lots of other things.
Sure.
And so my ability to discern some salient fact of my experience and then reason from that infallibly to the will of God is really a con that I'm pulling over on myself. And what it subjects me to is having an intuition or a deep desire that I want to be God's will, and then looking around for confirmation of that fact in my circumstances, ignoring all the contrary signs and evidences, and zeroing in on that one salient fact that would seem to justify my predetermined decision or outcome. And when you've reasoned with somebody like this, you know, hey, I really don't think you should leave your wife and run away with the department secretary. Oh no, God told me. You get that kind of craziness, right? So I'm very down on that. It is fine. It's in fact the teaching of Scripture. We should pray at all times. Now, Catholic writers through the centuries have given many different interpretations to that command. Obviously, it cannot mean that we keep up a conscious verbal dialogue 24/7 with God. It's impossible. It's physically impossible to do, right? So that can't be what it means. St. Augustine teaches that it basically means that we cultivate a habitual desire to be united to God. And so prayer can take the form of you know, verbally articulated prayers, but it, more importantly, it's the disposition that I have to do the will of God and be united with Him. That's essentially what it means to pray without ceasing. Now, there's no reason you should not pray verbally with these little ejaculatory prayers moment to moment about things like the lost car keys or whatever else it might be. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that, right? But the essential point is that I'm seeking to be united with the will of God in my life. Now, talking about the Lord's Prayer, and this again is the teaching of St. Augustine, the purpose of the Lord's Prayer, and in effect of all prayer, is not so much to get what I want as it is to change what I want. And so when it comes to things like how do I make decisions in prayer and how does prayer play into that, rather than going to God with, you know, do I go to law school or do I go on the mission field? All right, I'm now going to toss my Bible in the air and see what chapter and verse falls open in front of me. That'd be kind of a superstitious way to try to read tea leaves. Rather, I want the life of prayer and the whole practice of the faith to come to condition my values so that I can make a reasonable judgment about what are my gifts, what are my talents, What are my charisms? What are my desires? How do I think I can best serve God in the world? What's my vocation? And then you make a reasonable judgment, a prudent judgment, taking counsel with wise people, seeking to follow examples, you know, an honest assessment of what my strengths and weaknesses are, so that my decisions, while not infallible, are grounded in reason and good sense and a proper sense of vocation to Catholic life.
Linda, is that helpful for you?
Yes, very much. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your call, and glad you're listening there in Iowa on Aquinas Communications. Hey, that opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Call to Communion on this Wednesday afternoon here on EWTN. Let's go now to Stephanie in Somerville, Ohio, listening on the Great Sacred Heart Radio. Hey, Stephanie, what's on your mind today?
Hi, thanks to you both for taking my call. And Dr. Anders, I cannot thank you enough for all of your insight and your knowledge. It has truly helped me in my own growth in Catholicism, and it is greatly appreciated. I wanted to bring up an issue that my brother is of Baptist faith, and I am, of course, Catholic. And some years ago, he divorced his wife, and he met another woman and was looking to remarry. And he called me because he knows I'm Catholic, and he asked me, you know, what does your faith teach you about this? And I said, of course, we do not approve of this. I mean, there are steps if you're Catholic, you know, with annulling and those kinds of things. But he doesn't believe that. And he got married anyway. I did not attend. And he's held a grudge against me since, which is fine. I understand some of this comes with pains in life when you have your faith. A bit of a cross, I might say. But what is the church's teaching on other faiths who do not hold this truth? Are they held to the same account?
Thanks.
As we are.
Yeah, I appreciate the question. I've got about a minute till the break, so I'm going to do what I can. I may have to carry the question over to the other side. So the doctrine of marriage is a place where the Protestant tradition and the Catholic tradition diverge radically. It was one of the biggest points of contention in the 16th century when the Protestant Reformation came online. And we often think about sola scriptura and sola fide, these Protestant doctrines being the big thing. But socially, probably the most divisive thing in the Reformation was the change in the doctrine of marriage. And there are basically two points on which Protestantism departed from Catholic tradition on the nature of marriage. Most importantly, Protestants rejected the doctrine that marriage is a sacrament. They didn't reject the idea that marriage is a divine institution, but they thought it was a divine institution in the same way that, say, civil government is a divine institution. God established civil government for the well-being of society. They thought, well, you establish this civil institution called marriage for the well-being of society. So it's divine, and there are principles governing it, but it's not a sacrament. It's not an efficacious means of grace, and it doesn't belong essentially to the church's constitution in quite the same way that, you know, something like the Eucharist or baptism would. So they denied the sacramentality of the Eucharist. Now, because they denied it was a sacrament, they also denied that the church had jurisdiction over marriage in the way that the Catholic Church claims. So they really did make it more of an issue of civil religion, I mean, mm-hmm. of civil law rather than of canonical mm-hmm. ecclesiastical law.
Uh-huh.
The other major difference between Protestants and Catholics on marriage was that Protestants denied that marriage is indissoluble. Now, many of them take a very dim view of divorce in most circumstances, but they all allow for the possibility of divorce genuinely ending the bond of matrimony in a few circumstances, and I'll come back to those on the other side of the break.
Sit tight there, Stephanie. We'll continue that in just a moment. We'll also talk with Robert driving through Iowa, Matt in Cincinnati, Don in Waco, Felix in Nebraska. Lots more straight ahead on this edition of Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. So what's stopping you from becoming a Catholic? Let's talk about that here on EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. Before the break, we were talking with Stephanie in Somerville, Ohio. Stephanie's brother is wanting to remarry. He did, in fact, remarry. But now Stephanie wants to know, do Protestants hold the same view that we do on marriage?
Yes. And also, what do Catholics think about Protestants who do un-Catholic things regarding marriage?
So yes.
Before the break, I was explaining some of the differences. Protestants reject the doctrine that marriage is a sacrament. They also reject the doctrine that marriage is, in principle, indissoluble. Now, originally, Protestants recognized really only two reasons to legitimate divorce. One would be adultery, and the other would be abandonment. And in those instances, they would allow for divorce and subsequent remarriage. And so that was the real point at issue, because Catholics have always recognized that people might desist from conjugal living. Right? A married couple might have irreconcilable differences so severe they couldn't live under the same roof, and they may even have to have recourse to legal protections. And today that would take the form of civil divorce, to protect themselves in case, say, you had an aggressive or abusive spouse, for example. But that doesn't, from the Catholic point of view, that doesn't end the bond of a lawful marriage. And so such a person who's lawfully married, validly married, even if they obtain a civil divorce, cannot remarry, because that would be bigamy, right?
Mm-hmm.
So those are the major differences between Protestants and Catholics. Now, from the Catholic point of view, the fact that you don't acknowledge the sacramentality of marriage does not stop your marriage from being sacramental. So Protestants, putatively, presumptively, can have valid sacramental marriages. And thus, they also would be bound by the obligation not to dissolve those marriages. And if they do seek a civil divorce for some reason, it would be immoral for them to marry a second time. Now, the fact that they don't recognize that doesn't make that not a moral reality. Now, does a person's ignorance of the moral law go to their culpability? Well, sure it does. Sure it does. Of course it does. A person is less culpable for an immoral act if they don't understand that it's immoral, and if there's some serious impediment to their understanding that it's immoral, then they're not as culpable. It doesn't mean the act itself is not harmful. It's sort of like, if I don't know that it's wrong to murder, that doesn't give me a pass to murder. if I kill someone, they're still dead. I mean, something bad has happened. The fact that I may not be as responsible as somebody else doesn't just give me a carte blanche to go out killing people, right? In the same way, the fact that I don't know that this is wrong doesn't mean that my actions are not still harmful, right? So, but it's not our job, nor is it the church's job, to judge the conscience of such a person. We can state objectively, this is a bad thing to do, but we really leave the judgment of conscience up to God. So, in the public forum, in the public sphere, we can say, yeah, this is not the way you ought to conduct marriages.
Mm.
But in the internal forum of the conscience, then we let God be the judge. And that gives you freedom to love and accept your brother without judgment.
Yeah.
As Christ tells us, don't judge lest you be judged. We can judge a behavior, but we don't have to judge the person.
Stephanie, thanks so much for your call. Hope that's helpful for you. It's Call to Communion here on EWTN Radio. Going to now to Felix, a first-time listener in Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Hello, Felix. What's on your mind today?
Hey, this is the first time I've called or even listened to the show. I'm driving through Nebraska for work and just having a really hard time being alone right now.
Mm.
So I was dating a woman for a year, and there was a lot of contention in the relationship centered around religion. Her and her family are really devout Christians, and I'd consider myself kind of religiously homeless. I do believe there's a creator, and there probably is a correct religion, but I haven't found it for myself yet. And we had a lot of contention on that. Worked through it. I was going to church with her and her family and trying to find it for myself. And in the end, she ended up actually cheating on me. And after a year, I just kind of found out all the things we kind of held sacred and all the reasons I really fell for her and trusted her were lies from the start. And now I'm having a hard time understanding why I should keep searching for a religion or involving myself in the religious community when it seems like so many of the most devout religious people I meet don't live religious lives in the slightest behind closed doors.
Yeah. Wow, Fakes, great question. I really appreciate it. And I'm so glad you called today. Thank you. I really, really appreciate you. So this is a Catholic radio show on a Catholic radio station. So the answers that I give you are going to be particular to Catholicism, right? I'm not particularly interested in promoting something called religion. Like, that's not my job here. I am interested in talking about the Catholic Church and the Catholic answers to life questions. I'll tell you first, right off the bat, that at least within the Catholic Church, I have been treated badly and betrayed and lied to and manipulated by Catholic people. I have been singularly unimpressed with Catholic lives, with hypocrisy, with superstition, with attention to outward ceremonies and doctrines without real regard for the transformation of interior lives and character. And I would like to add that I am guilty of all of the things I just criticized. So everything that I have found reprehensible about the lives of other Catholics could also be said of me. All right. I will confess to the crime of hypocrisy right now. All right. I'll confess to the sin of superstition, of shallowness, of lording it over others, of nitpicking on doctrines and ceremonies and ideas while disregarding the dignity of persons. I've done all of that. Okay. However, I recognize all of that is wrong. Everything for which I just indicted myself and the rest of my community, I recognize objectively that that's bad. One of the reasons that I am a Christian, it's not the only reason, but one of the reasons that I am a Christian is when I study the Gospels, the books about Jesus, I find that that was Jesus' major concern. When you actually read what Jesus said about the religious life, most of what he had to say, particularly when he interacted with other religious people and discussed their practice, was to draw attention to just the kind of faults that you have mentioned and to say, that's the wrong way to do it. And so the person of Jesus is always calling me back to a consideration of my motives, my virtues or lack thereof, my love or charity or my lack thereof, and all of the fake masks and artificiality and posing and posturing that people are wont to do to impress their neighbors and to self-aggrandize. Now, it's not only religious people that do this. I mean, you'll find this in corporations. You'll find it in political parties.
Oh, yeah.
It's a natural human behavior. But Jesus is the one that has called my attention to that fact, made it salient to me, and has given me tools to try to confront the problem. Now, from a Catholic point of view, what really counts at the end of the day is, are you living a charitable life? Charity is a fancy word for love. Like, are you loving your neighbor as yourself? Are you living a virtuous life? Now, virtue is a word that gets thrown around a lot. People mean different things, but I mean, is your life a well-balanced life so that your actions, your desires, your behavior, your activities are attractive, that they're noble, that the kind of things that, you know, you would want your child or grandchildren to emulate, right? You're living that kind of life. And that includes, are you living a reasonable life? A life where reason itself, where rationality is a principal concern, a principal criteria for judging human action, not superstition, not mumbo jumbo, but a rational assessment of the human and common good. And are you committed to that? Those are all Catholic values, and the reasons why I continue to practice in the Catholic Church, because without the Catholic Church and without the teaching of Jesus, well, I wouldn't have the tools that I need to confront the hypocrisy and the posing and the artificiality that you find so reprehensible in human behavior.
There you go, Felix, and thank you so much for your call. We're glad that you checked in with us today in Nebraska. Drive safe in the area there. It's called a communion here on EWTN Radio. Let's go now to Matt. Matt is in Cincinnati listening on the Great Sacred Heart Radio. Hey, Matt, what's on your mind today, sir?
Thank you. Earlier in today's calls, there were a lot of questions about the roles and responsibilities of Catholics and our job, so to speak. So here's one about father to son, both Catholic. Son is in the mid-20s, out on his own, dating another Catholic for about 4 years now, and an engagement will happen next year. and the son properly asks the parents about this decision to maybe live together for a convenience factor of some undetermined time and asks our thoughts on this. So I'm collecting my own thoughts, and my plan would be to play the long game, as we often talk about on this show, and explain simply the tenets of the faith, appealing to his reason, asking him to go seek out the council of priests, etc. But I was just wondering if there's something else that I might be thinking of or planning on my end.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So what he proposes to do can be shown sociologically, statistically, to damage the chances that he will have a lasting marriage. When couples cohabitate before marriage, they are far more likely to divorce. And in the relationship, I don't care what his ideological justification is, the form that cohabitation takes is it advantages the sexual appetite of men over the dignity of women. And there is a work that you might consult in preparation for the conversation by the Catholic sociologist Mark Regnerus. I believe the title of the book is Cheap Sex. And it's about the transformation in the sexual marketplace between men and women in the last 50 years in the Western world. And basically, Regnerus' thesis is the way we have cheapened sexuality in our culture over the last 50 years has been massively disadvantageous to women. And so I think this is not fair to her, and it's not fair to him or to their hopes for future relationship. Now, you can have this conversation without importing a lot of religious vocabulary or thou shalt nots. You can have it in terms of what does the research show? What does the research show? There's no evidence that, you know, trying the thing out improves the odds of success. The research shows the exact opposite.
There you go. And we, too, appreciate your call, Matt, from Cincinnati. It's called The Communion here on EWTN. Tomorrow morning, be sure to check out Women of Grace with John Ed Williams. That'll be at 11 a.m. Eastern. John Ed shows you how to embrace the Catholic life with joy and peace. We could all use a little more joy and peace in our lives, that's for sure. Do check it out tomorrow morning, 11 a.m. Eastern, only on EWTN Radio. We're going to Waco now and talking with Don, listening on the great Red Sea Catholic Radio. Hey, Don, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I have a question. I love your show, first off. You know, I always find it funny when I talk to people that say that, you know, they were Catholic from first through 12th grade. They went to Catholic school, and then they always preface it by saying, I had trouble with, you know, fill in the blank. And then what they come up with is, you know, a theology, you know, from a Protestant denomination, like almost word for word, like they came up with that on their own, rather than them being shown from, you know, the Protestant church. So that's just one thing. I just wanted to know how you felt about that. And then second, the reason I'm asking really is I'm about ready to teach a confirmation class again at a different parish. And I was wondering how you would handle, like, not getting too heavily involved in, let's say, the history or the numbers versus not getting too light. And so I don't want to lose them on the too heavy, but I don't want to be too light. So I'll listen to your comments here.
Yeah, thanks. Let me see if I understand. The first question is that when people leave the Catholic faith, they often justify leaving the faith by singling out some particular Catholic dogma and saying, well, I didn't find this dogma to be true because I found blank, and they usually give whatever the Protestant sort of alternative to that is, and that seems more compelling to them. And your objection to that is it seems like they didn't independently discover the truth of this Protestant doctrine, but they sort of absorbed it either from the culture or from maybe, you know, somebody proselytized them, and they've persuaded themselves of the truth of this. It's provided them with a justification for their decision to leave the church. I think you're dead right. I think you're dead right. The research shows that when the most people who leave the church and join another Christian denomination, the primary reason they give in survey after survey is that their spiritual needs weren't being met within the Catholic faith. All right. And what that, I take that quite seriously, and I believe it. I think that's true, right? I think that there were pastoral failures in their relationship to the Catholic Church that made it impossible for them to connect to Catholic liturgy and doctrine and devotion, spirituality and moral life in a way that they felt to be transformative and positive. And so they went and sought that someplace else. Now, as a historian of religion, not just of Catholicism, I also think that you can get people to believe just about anything. I mean, you could start the Church of the Mystic Hamburger. And if you follow the right kind of formula, which is to, you know, kind of make moral demands on people and give them a message of transcendent meaning and provide community for them and give them a community of discourse in which they kind of begin to share ideas and concepts with people whose affection they want and whom they want to impress, you can coerce them into believing just about anything. So I really don't think the specific doctrines are necessarily what draw them out of the church. I think that there are people sometimes who are frustrated with the church who at a subconscious level go looking to justify that frustration by maybe doing apologetical investigations and reading texts, but what really motivates them is their dissatisfaction. And what they end up with is going to depend basically on just what literature they read or what group they fall into, right? Mm-hmm. So I do think there's some great truth in that intuition that you just had. You know, by the same token, Catholics can also rely on some of those same sociological truths. So the more we gather around people and give them a sense of community, the more we help them to like share a common sort of universe of discourse, the more we provide them with a message of transcendent meaning that's embodied both in our rituals and our lives, the more they're going to connect to the doctrines of the church and find them meaningful and embrace mm-hmm. them, right? So
sure.
That goes to the second question, which is about the proper mode of confirmation. And the research also shows that the vast majority of kids that get confirmed, say age 13, 14, will not be practicing the faith 7 years down the line. And by the time they get out of college, the numbers are quite devastating these days, right? So most of the defections from the Catholic faith take place before the age of, say, 25, all right? So this is a really critical question that you're asking, how to go about confirmation, preparing for confirmation. And, of course, this is not my specific area of ministry expertise. There are others who are much, much more skilled and knowledgeable about this age group and their developmental needs than I am. But I will give you some general thoughts from working with some of these folks. The doctrine of the faith is important. History of the church is important. At the end of the day, I don't think those are the things that are going to determine whether or not these kids leave the church when they're 18, 19, 20. I think it's much more those psychological and sociological conditions of have they learned to connect to the church and the community of the faithful in a way that gives them a life of transcendent meaning, right? And so I think when you're involved in youth ministry of any kind, it's important to teach Catholic doctrine. It's important to teach Catholic morality. It's important to do the catechesis. But it's vastly more important to find ways to actually connect young people to the life of the church. Here are some things that work. Kids resonate, humans resonate, adults resonate with service. So many confirmation programs will require that kids do service work, but the more that can be coordinated to the actual life of the parish, the more effective it is. You know, when you can get them on youth service days where they can feel good about their contributions as Catholic, where they can see other Catholics, maybe grown-up Catholics. Catholics are great at doing charity. We're terrible at advertising it. You know, there's so many unsung heroes, and you know, there's virtue in that, of course,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But the problem is, you know, you might look down the street and some, you know, Protestant megachurch, they've all got on, you know, T-shirts that say, you know, like, you know, Church of the Mystic Hamburger out, you know, doing, you know, food handout for the homeless.
Sure, sure.
And it's very evident that they're involved in social ministry. Sometimes the way Catholics do it, it's not as evident. So the more you can get them involved in seeing Catholics do work and put them involved where they can feel connected to it, that's very useful, right? Eucharistic adoration tends to resonate really, really well with young people. I think better with young people sometimes than with other age groups. Those can be guided meditations. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes people have music involved or maybe prayers that have been provided for them. But anything you can do like that. Going on retreat and pilgrimages, many, many young people will point to their retreat experience as a time when they made a personal decision to commit themselves more deeply to the life of the Catholic faith. So all of those kinds of things outside of the liturgy that can help young people actually find points of meaningful connection to and participation in the life of the church go a long way to helping them stay Catholic.
Robert, we hope it, Don, we hope it goes well for you. Thank you so much for your call from Waco. Now we're going to go to Robert, driving through Iowa, listening on the great Iowa Catholic Radio. Hey, Robert, what's on your mind today, sir?
Hello, how you doing?
Great.
You know, I want to say I've been listening here, and every caller after caller, you've been like Johnny on the spot with deliverance. The work, your explanations are like choice silver and apples of gold. So I hope everyone is taking advantage of your gift.
Wow. Thanks, Robert. So, and I hope they're listening to you, too.
Yeah.
What's, oh, my God.
Hey, what's on your mind today, Robert?
Yeah, what's on my mind today is what's been on my mind for the last 10 years or so when after reading the Bible pretty much all my life and all I've ever known is Jesus, I haven't bounced around from religion to religion, and today I just, I'm just doing the best I can to just, follow Jesus with the word he's given us, and that brings me to my focus of the question. It's been brought to me just from the reading of the Bible, the way God gave it to us, it just would occur to me that it's plain as the nose on our face that the words that we've handled all our life are more than, they're not just vehicles of communication, just words, but they are indeed, spirit. Well, I'm just going straight to the point in the heart of it. We don't have time for me to build everything up. I've come to see how words indeed are spirit.
I think I can speak to that, Robert. I may have to let me talk for a second because I only got about a minute left. So if I understand you correctly, I think I agree with you, right, that the words on the text are not merely intended by God to inform our ideas. They're actually intended to transform our character. If they're not transformative, if they don't enter into the marrow of our bones and change the way we experience reality and ourselves and one another, then they are just words on the page, right? And in fact, what you articulate is precisely the teaching of St. Paul. When Paul writes about this question in 1 Corinthians chapters 2 and 3, and he speaks about those for whom the words on the page are just that. They're words on the page, or perhaps they're legal prescriptions, or maybe incorporated into some ideology, but they don't really transform the character. But the person who reads the word or hears the word with the Spirit of Christ finds them transformative such that that individual comes to, and this is Paul's terminology, have the mind of Christ, to have the mind of Christ. Pope Benedict said one time that faith is not just gazing at Jesus, it's coming to see the world through Christ's eyes, coming to see with Christ's perspective. And I think that may be what you're referring to when you say that they're not just words, they're spirit, they're transformative, they change our way of being, they change our way of perceiving. If we read them right, if we incorporate, assimilate them into our lives, we can see the world through Christ's eyes. And that's the end of all Christian discipleship.
Yes, indeed. Robert, thank you so much for your call. I really wanted to get to Michael in Cleveland, who has a question about needing some help with decision-making. However, Michael, we are flat out of time. If you could please call us back tomorrow or on the day of your choice, I promise we will put you at the head of the line, and that's Scout's honor. There were also a bunch of questions that came in. Scotty on YouTube, an anonymous question on Facebook. We're going to hold those over till either tomorrow or another show very, very soon. So thank you for your contributions. And Dr. David Andrews, thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Don't forget, we do this program Monday through Friday here on EWTN Radio, 2 p.m. Eastern for the live show, 11 p.m. for the encore, Monday through Friday. You can check out the podcast anytime. Rich will have that posted for you in the next hour or so, EWTNradio.net, EWTNradio.net. On behalf of our fantastic team, and today that would be Rich, Matt, and Ace, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Andrews. Thanks for joining us. See you next time here on EWTN's Call to Communion. God bless.